Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Is America washing its hands of Syria? On December 19th, President Trump announced the rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria, saying the Islamic State has been defeated in the region and America's mission was complete. The announcement drew sharp criticism from military leaders. Defense Secretary James Mattis resigned. Brett McGurk, the U.S. Special Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat the Islamic State, also resigned and called rapid withdrawal reckless. Since that announcement on December 19th, the president has backed off on the time frame for America's departure, but the overall strategy remains controversial. Tim Shorn is Director of International Studies and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, and he joins us today from the SDPB studios in Vermilion. Tim Shorn, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be back in the new year.
All right. So let's talk about why this announcement was so shocking to, average citizens, but also to military leaders. What was the big deal?
Well, it seems that when President Trump made his decision to withdraw American troops from Syria immediately, that perhaps he hadn't consulted with anyone in the Defense Department, to include Secretary Mattis. He took the people in the White House by surprise, and it certainly took our allies around the world by surprise as well. And so what we had was a lot of people, both within the American government and as leaders of our allies, trying to figure out what their policy was going to be after America's withdrawal, what their next step would need to be, and perhaps even the bigger question, if we were withdrawing from Syria, what would President Trump's next step in the world be militarily? And so it was a big surprise for everyone, and it raised more questions than it could ever possibly answer.
So one of the things the president has said primarily through Twitter is, well, this is what I promised to do in the first place. And then I go back to when President Obama was in office, and he was sharply criticized for not listening to his military leaders on the ground in Afghanistan, for example. President Trump, when he was elected, was praised for listening to the military leadership. Has his strategy changed? Are those contradictions? Is it just this sort of overall notion of somewhat unpredictability?
Well, I think there's a very big element of unpredictability. At the same time, President Trump did want to draw back our military forces from around the world. He felt that we were expending a good deal of money and not getting much in return. Obviously, there are people on the other side who would say that the expense is well worth our involvement in the world. I think that, part of the problem is that we rarely have an open and honest and transparent discussion, either in Congress, in Washington, or in the United States, about what do we want to accomplish when we send our troops abroad? Is there an end date when we've decided either we're going to succeed or we're not, and so therefore we need to change our plans? And so what we oftentimes see are presidents making a decision during the course of their campaign about what their policy is going to be, and then attempt to implement it without necessarily a lot of advice and input from the experts, and without any real conversation going on in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's probably our problem. It's not necessarily wrong to decide to withdraw troops from Syria, but we need to know, why were they there in the first place? What did we want to accomplish? Why are we withdrawing them now? What is the long-term impact going to be of that withdrawal? And we oftentimes simply jump into a decision as a country without considering some of the other implications.
Let's talk about some of those implications. And one of the challenges is this thought that the U.S. troop withdrawal creates a vacuum of sorts in Syria. Tell us who the players are here and who might fill that vacuum. What are the risks of especially a rapid? And I think, the timeline is flexible now, but it's, in months, not days. It's still happening fairly quickly. So, what happens next in the region?
Well, I think the first myth we need to dispel is that ISIS is defeated.
Okay.
When we look at what's going on in Syria and probably still in parts of Iraq, we're looking at 20 to 30,000 ISIS fighters who remain. Now, ISIS does not control the territory that they used to. They do not have the type of kind of government and command structure that they once had. They are not able to control all things and all people in the areas that they governed for a short term. But that doesn't mean that ISIS is defeated. There's still a significant number of people there. With the American withdrawal, we can expect that ISIS is going to attempt to reassert itself in particular areas of Syria and perhaps Iraq. One of the things that we need to consider is that the primary focus of Syria or the Russian government and the Iranian government was never combating ISIS. It was supporting the Assad regime and controlling any internal opposition that might arise. Consequently, if the United States leaves, we can expect ISIS to start to fill the vacuum. At the same time, we are announcing that we have no interest in containing Iran or Russia, that we are content with the Assad regime remaining in power. And we also then give a certain space to Hezbollah of Lebanon, who has had a major presence in Syria. And then, of course, we have Turkey, who is looking for an opportunity to control the Kurdish population, to put down the Kurdish militia within Syria, and in order to further control their own Kurdish population. So there is a lot going on, and none of that is going to get better with the American withdrawal. In fact, we can probably expect that some of those forces are going to become more aggressive. And they're going to attempt to reassert themselves and achieve their own goals.
And tell us, you know, remind us exactly, you know, the 2,000 troops that, you know, are scheduled, roughly 2,000, some say it could be much more, who are scheduled to leave Syria. Who are we supporting? If we're not supporting, you know, Russia, we're not supporting Iran, obviously, we're supporting the Assad regime. These are Kurdish-led democratic forces. Whose side were we on?
Well, we did certainly want to prevent the Kurds from being annihilated, either by the Assad regime or beaten up by the Turks. At the same time, by having a presence in Syria, it was our hope to prevent any greater ISIS involvement in Iraq. Iraq has calmed a bit. There's always an opportunity for a flare up, but I think part of our presence there, or part of the purpose for our presence, was to build a bit of a firewall around ISIS, and then to continue to force ISIS to constrict and to give up some of the territory that they had controlled. So I think primarily our focus was ISIS. The problem is that we were oftentimes fighting ISIS nearly alone.
Mm. All right. So if we were to stay, when you talk about an exit strategy, what does sort of count as, you know, we've won? I mean, when you have, you know, you have so many fighters, but it's going to be very difficult to eliminate all of them. Is it better to have a long-term strategy and be in a place like Syria permanently? What is the situation that that Americans might understand or support?
And that is the question, and it's the question that policymakers really haven't attempted to answer.
Yeah.
You know, what does success look like? Mm-hmm. And to be slightly pessimistic, I don't think we are ever going to see anything that resembles success. We're not going to see a situation where we can say, we have accomplished what we wanted to do, we're finished, we can leave holding our heads up high. We're not going to see that. This is an issue that is going to remain for the long term. Even as Assad and his allies, Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, reassert control over parts of Syria, I would expect that parts of Syria will remain outside their writ, and that's where ISIS will remain. and a full withdrawal by us means that ISIS can rise up again. Mm-hmm. A presence in Syria simply means that there is someone there to contain ISIS. One of the wild cards that we simply don't know, we're not sure what they will do, is Israel. We know that they are very concerned about having Iranian forces just north of their border, and that is going to continue to plague Israel's security establishment with concern. We also know that domestically, Israeli politics are very much in turmoil right now, with Prime Minister Netanyahu calling early elections. So the question becomes, will some of Israel's responses become kind of domestically, politically inspired? What will the response be from Iran? And it's hopeful that by having an American presence in Syria, that there is at least some pressure that we can apply on Israel to prevent it from doing anything that might result in blowback for both them and us.
So Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, and they sort of, you know, vow to continue working together. What does that mean? Is that largely symbolic at this point towards an acknowledgement of the challenges and a promise to sort of partner on intelligence? Or is that, how do we sort of view that kind of meaning? Handshaking,
well,
yeah.
And that's a good question, too. I would expect that administration of President Trump is probably giving Prime Minister Netanyahu a brighter green light than other administrations might have, without fully understanding what the consequences may be. Because if the Israeli government decides to become more forceful in its response to the Iranian and Hezbollah presence in Syria, we have to expect that there's going to be a response from Syria or from Iran and Hezbollah against Israel. And so, you know, we know that Israel has real, honest security concerns. The problem is how do they address those, and what are the consequences going to be for Israel, for the United States, and then subsequently also for Syria and Lebanon? There are just a heck of a lot of unknowns. And what we need are leaders to attempt to pull back and say, you know, to ask, you know, what are we willing to accept? What are our red lines going to be? And what are we willing to do to stop someone from crossing those red lines? And that's a discussion that really needs to be had in a number of capitals.
So when we look at sort of the decision, especially the use of Twitter to sort of make some of these announcements, and do we see the president, and I specifically want to talk about James Mattis resigning his position, do we see the president making decisions in isolation? Do we see the thumbprints of National Security Advisor John Bolton in this policy? I know it's difficult to ascertain from the outside, and there's, you know, speculation, but James Mattis' resignation is by no means insignificant in this conversation.
No, that is a big deal. Yeah. And I have also been asking, what role is National Security Advisor John Bolton playing? Who else in the White House may have been advising President Trump? Or was this a decision that he made on his own in isolation, saying, look, we're not going to accomplish anything in Syria. I said we were going to withdraw our troops. It's time to do it. And so, you know, it becomes problematic if a president of the United States is ignoring his national security and defense advisors and the experts that they depend on. It becomes problematic when the president has an inner core of advisors who are divorced from the apparatus, whether it be the National Security Council, whether it's the Pentagon, State Department, intelligence community. All of those parts exist for a reason, and they are there to come together to advise the president and then to carry out his policies. And so it becomes a little bit of an issue, and I do have to say that President Trump is not the first president in the United States, nor will he be the last, to ignore the experts. That is oftentimes a problem. But in this case, he undermined the authority of some of his staff members, his cabinet, and clearly has a very different view than, for example, Secretary Mattis had. And I can understand that Secretary Mattis said, at some point, there are policies I cannot support. There are policies of the president that I cannot carry out. But as a cabinet member, I have a choice. I either carry out the president's policies or I move on. And Secretary Mattis clearly decided to move on, which probably has the military commanders a bit nervous because now they're not sure what the next step is going to be either.
What happens to the refugees, the asylum seekers, the displaced in this scenario? What are we seeing right now?
This is the largest issue, I would say, and the issue that is being completely ignored. We have watched essentially a religious cleansing of Syria, where over half of the population has been displaced, a quarter of the population finds themselves refugees in a number of countries in the region. And it has been clear from the government of President Assad that those refugees are not going to be welcomed back. Some maybe, but not all. This is an attempt by the Assad regime to cobble together and protect his coalition of Alawites and Christians to ensure that their security and economic and political situation remains strong. And if that means preventing 6 million Sunni refugees from returning, he will absolutely do that, which means we're looking at refugees that will probably be outside of the country for decades and perhaps never with the opportunity to return, which means we are sowing the seeds for future conflict, future radicalism, future extremism in a generation or two. At the same time, we're going to see continued malnutrition, continued medical issues, lack of education, lack of hope. And so the 6 million refugees are going to be a price that the world pays for not cracking down on President Assad earlier. Mm-hmm.